Good morning to you. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Certainly glad to have you with us as we begin second hour of the show. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with someone who is a well-known entrepreneur in the field of information technology. His name is Gururaj Deshpande, and he has started three companies, two of which have been quite successful. Most recently, he was the co-founder of Sycamore Networks. That's a company that revolutionized the optical network. He was born and grew up in India and studied there at the as a degree from the Indian Institute of Technology. From there, he went to study in Canada and has a master's degree in electrical engineering from University of New Brunswick and PhD in data communications from Queen's University in Canada. Before starting Sycamore Networks, he was founder and chairman of Cascade Communications. Between 1991 and 1997, that company grew from a one-person startup to a company with $500 million in revenue and 900 employees. In 1997, it was sold for $3.7 billion, and not long after that was also acquired by Lucent, right? Was it Lucent Technologies?
Yes,
for a cool $21 billion. So the company's done very well. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to take part in a large conference on the future of information technology, and he's been very good to come and sit here and talk a little bit with us. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions certainly are welcome. We just encourage people to try to be brief, but certainly anyone can call and be a part of the conversation. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David.
We appreciate it. How did you get interested in ultimately the line of work that you went into? And you were studying, technology issues, some of these kinds of things, at least going back to the point where you were an undergraduate when you went to college in India. Was this a field that always interested you?
You know, David, some people are born and they say, this is what I want to be. I can't claim that that's been my career or life. You know, it's. I think most of the careers are a series of accidents, and you just come across people, opportunities, and you grab them as you go along. So, you know, if you grow up in India, your only ticket to being able to do anything is education. So you focus on education, and I went to a good school and came to Canada, and then I thought I would be a professor. So I went ahead and got a PhD, and then I had a fork in my career and landed up working for Motorola in Toronto. And then I did something there which was sort of more entrepreneurial. And that sort of got me into the entrepreneurial business, and I've been in Boston now for the last 25 years, and it's been a real good experience. And I find that every 4 or 5 years, you know, your life changes, what's important for you changes, you come across situations and people, and I think if you have the good fortune to grab the opportunities, different things will happen to you.
Mm-hmm. Is it that you happened to go to, when you were continuing your education, you happened to go to New Brunswick, of all places?
Well, you know, I think it turned out to be a great opportunity for me. But when I was finishing up my undergrad in India, we had a visiting professor from University of Alberta in Canada. And he was the source of that inspiration. He said, mm-hmm. Hey, why don't you apply to these Canadian universities? And I applied to about three of them. And University of New Brunswick came back with a full scholarship. And that's what got me to Canada.
Yeah. I'm interested in the fact that when you were pursuing your PhD, this would have been in the early 1970s, mm-hmm. that you were in the field of data communications. And I would think that now that's that's an enormous, still growing, explosive field, and there's great opportunities there, and there's a lot of money to be made and so forth. I'm not sure that in 1973, when you got your PhD, that would have been so much the case. Was there something about that area that even at that point you thought, here's a great opportunity for growth in this field?
Well, you know, in the 70s, that used to be sort of the frontier. You know, frontier of technology. You know, we were all struggling to see, you know, most of the telephone network was built for making phone calls and trying to connect computers on those networks used to be the real challenge. And so, you know, it's really interesting. It wasn't that long ago. It's only 25 years ago. But all of us used to try to make computers pretend like they were human beings making phone calls to each other. And so, you know, you'd almost, the computers would whistle and you'd try to decode. The other computer would try to decode as to how fast you're whistling. And so, you know, trying to get about 1,200 bits per second over a phone line used to be the real challenge. And it's amazing how far we've come in the last 25 years.
Yeah. Well, and I guess I have to be honest, from what little I think I understand of what Sycamore is all about, that's essentially what the goal there is to not just to transmit data, but other kinds of information over a phone line, or I suppose in this case where we're talking about fiber optics, and that is trying to, you know, your pipe is only so big, but somehow you're trying to squeeze more and more stuff through that pipe, and that's kind of what, as I understand it, you can tell me if I'm wrong, what Sycamore is
well,
about.
You know, I think it's sort of the first company led to the second company. The first one, Cascade Communication, into 1990. Now it looks obvious, but those days, you know, every phone is connected to every other phone, which is very natural. Yeah. But that wasn't the case in 1990 with computers.
Right.
You know, people used to connect computers within a company. So Cascade was based on the promise that every phone would get connected to every other phone, in which case the computer network has to be a public network. And that's what created Cascade. But by 97, you know, Cisco was very big, which is a very big company now. But all of us used to struggle a lot in terms of how do we send all this computer information on very limited capacity? Because the capacity used to be very limited. You know, if you got one small link from Chicago to California, you'd pay $1 million a month. And then came along fiber optics, where you could send this laser beam and blink the laser beam at 10 billion times a second. So it's almost like, you know, rationing for oil versus suddenly finding these oil fields. And so the fiber optic really opened up this whole constraint on the capacity that you had. And that was the big opportunity to actually build these networks where you had so much capacity that you didn't have to really struggle too much with putting the most important thing ahead of the least important things and so on. Mm.
So is for somebody like me who's really not a tech guy, explain what it is that that Sycamore Networks do.
So people, you know, you buy the right of way and then you put the fiber.
Right, okay.
And then once you put the fiber, you have to create capacity on top of that fiber. So you put a laser beam on one side and you blink it and you decode it on the other side. And on one fiber, you can send one laser beam and get about 10 billion bits per second, right? And you can put about 200 laser beams on the same fiber, which is almost as thin as your hair, at different colors, at different frequencies, and you can decode them. So just like radio stations on fiber, but each of the laser beams is actually communicating at about 10 billion bits per second. So it's an enormous amount of capacity that you can create. And it just turned out that you know, that created the big bubble and all that kind of stuff. But what it really did is sort of really revolutionized the whole internet economy. You know, everything that people were talking about in 98, 99, which crossed the bubble, it's all coming true now. You know, it's really creating the global economy. It's really creating this big phenomenon that value creation has the same value irrespective of where you create it. And so suddenly now the whole world becomes a part of that global economy.
Mm. What is there still now a challenge, though, that as we depend more and more on that kind of transmission and exchange of data, there gets more of it? We expect it to be we expect that to happen in the blink of an eye. I mean, is it still here now an issue that we're still have to think about how it is we continue to improve systems of transmission so that we can accommodate an ever-growing amount of data and also the desire that people have that this is going to move as fast as it possibly can?
So it's just a seesaw, you know, you first, you could send 300 bits per second, and people said, okay, maybe we can use it for something. And then you get it up to a megabit, and then you can send some words and so on. And then you get it up to a million bits per second. Then you can send some graphics and color and so on. But now the next big thing is video. You know, I think so the more and more easier that you can communicate using very rich media, you need to communicate more bits. So it's always a seesaw. You know, the technology gets ahead of the curve a little bit. You create more capacity than what people need. But then people, you know, they don't need to understand all the technology. But they know that if they had more capacity, they could create richer media. And then that sort of chews up the whole capacity, and then you need to create more capacity, and then, you know, be able to manage it, and also, you know, the world still is growing very rapidly in terms of communications. You know, half the world has still not made a phone call yet, so there's still a lot of stuff that needs to get built in the world, and the world needs to catch up with even the basic communications, and then. Every business is trying to look for an advantage by being able to communicate and be connected more. So I don't see an end to this innovation for a long time to come.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Gururaj Deshpande. He's the co-founder and chairman of Sycamore Networks, Incorporated, has been involved in the IT field for quite a while now, has started up a couple of companies that have been quite successful. He has a degree in electrical engineering from the Indian Institute of Technology and then went, as he explained, to Canada for more time in university. He has degrees from University of New Brunswick and Queen's University in Canada, where he got his PhD and data communications, now makes his home in the United States, and is visiting here to talk about these kinds of issues as part of a conference here on the university with a lot of other people who are interested in this, people from different places, different countries who work in the IT field, and was good enough to come and spend a little time talking with us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I've read a few things about you, and it seems like most of the articles seem to make a point of mentioning your net worth. And certainly you have been very successful and have done well. Do you think that do we make too much of that? Or is that we just say, well, that's kind of the way the world is. And we certainly, yes, we are preoccupied with that. And that is one measure of success, how much money a person's got in the bank. So that's just kind of the way the world is. How do you think about that?
Well, you know, if you're an entrepreneur and if you're trying to create a business, you cannot create sustainable business unless you can actually create financial wealth. And I think that's something unique about United States, where, you know, the country actually creates an ecosystem where people can come in with ideas, create businesses, create wealth, create jobs, and then put that wealth to good use. And so you really create a cycle of, a very positive cycle of building the wealth, creating an economy, and creating new opportunities, and so on, and very, very, very impressed with, you know, with the way the wealth is, you know, filtered back into philanthropy and how it's put back to good use in the United States. I think it's a great culture. It's a culture that should be celebrated and I think encouraged, because that's the biggest asset that United States has.
Well, certainly you yourself have done that. I know that you've contributed some significant amounts of money to MIT, for example. Is that something that is more common than not? Certainly we have the example of Bill Gates in there, but other people who have made so much money you can't hardly imagine, who have actually then taken that and said, well, I want to try and do some good things with that, and have put it into various kinds of projects. Do you find that there are a lot of people who, like you and him, who are doing that very thing?
I think so. You know, I think it comes with the entrepreneurship. You know, when you're an entrepreneur, you're always trying to create impact. Initially, you create impact with your ideas, with your effort, and so on. And then as you build some wealth, you get another dimension to it. You have financial resources as well. But you're still always looking for that impact with the amount of time that you have, the amount of money that you have. And that impact, you know, does not necessarily have to be a business impact. It can be philanthropic impact. For example, the effort that we're doing at MIT, it's really to see if we can really change the way people innovate in universities and create a very sustainable innovation-driven economy in the U.S. because, you know, standard of living here is pretty high, and to maintain it and to grow from there, we constantly need to create new ways of doing things so that people here are a lot more productive than people in other parts of the world. And so, you know, creating and sort of just working on an experiment like that where you can bring innovation and relevance together and create a string of innovations that would have a huge impact, that's pretty exciting for me because I think it can have a long-lasting impact on the U.S. economy.
Yeah. I read that when you started Sycamore, you actually it was not that difficult for you to get the money, although I think half of the money was actually your money to start it, but that perhaps it was based on the strength of the success of Cascade, that had done so well, that you had a reputation and a track record. So I'm sure that then when you went out and looked for the rest of the money to start Sycamore, people could look at what you'd done before and said, well, we think that this we'll take a chance on this guy. It looks like he probably knows what he's doing. Is it, I would imagine, though, it still has to be more difficult for people who are starting from the beginning to get that kind of money.
Yes. I think the first beginning is always hard. But it's a lot easier now than it used to be, you know. 20, 30 years ago, when I got into this business, the venture capital was a new phenomenon. And it was new for people to just look at somebody who just walks into an office and say, hey, here, I have a great idea. Why don't you write me a check for $5 million? So those guys, you know, they would have a fund of maybe $40, $50, $60 million. So before they wrote the check, they wanted to make sure that you're committed. And committed to them meant that you had used up all your bank balance, you mortgaged your wife and kids, and you mowed your lawn, and you lived on nothing. You know, all those things, right? But now, the venture capital in U.S. is pretty evolved. It's billions and billions of dollars. So people actually think not that way, but they say, if this person has a good idea, I want to fund him and actually let him live a normal life because I don't want him to be struggling with other issues. I would want to see him live a comfortable life so that he can focus all his energy in this new venture. So the venture capital is a pretty developed phenomenon. And just like every university admits people, the venture capital community admits so many entrepreneurs into the club. And so there is a lot of entrepreneurial companies getting founded in U.S. So it's a well-established business. And also, you know, being an entrepreneur used to be a very risky career path. You know, either you made it or you didn't make it. Not anymore. You know, you can pick entrepreneurship as a career path. And typically it takes 4 or 5 years to play out the game. And you may be successful, you may not be successful because there's a lot of other factors involved in it. But if you fail in your first venture, not because you didn't work hard, because something didn't work for you, you actually have a higher premium for the next one. You know, people will seek out and fund you again, right? Mm. So every 5 years, if you play the game, and if you start playing the game in your early 20s or 30s, you're guaranteed to be successful because every time your opportunity to be more successful improves.
Well, you before Cascade, you co-founded Coral Network Corporation, is that right?
Yes.
And that was this one that was the router developer,
yes,
company? This was not a success.
No.
What happened with Coral were you then, what kind of position were you in after that then when you got to the point where you were working to put together Cascade?
Well, you know, it was, that's what happens, you know, when you're successful, people look at your success and say, hey, look, you know, it must be fun to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
But to be an entrepreneur, either then or now, you have to be prepared for a lot of hardship. But the good thing is, it doesn't look like hardship when you're doing it, because that's what you want to do. I mean, you know, the fact that you're denied this or that, you know, that doesn't really matter, because that's what you want to do. So those days, you actually had to go without a salary for at least 12 to 15 months before you get funded because people felt like that was a commitment. And so I and my wife saved enough money to last that long. And then we actually got funded. We raised $4 million. But about 3 months after we raised the money, I and my partner had a difference of opinion in terms of where we go from here. And you can't have two cooks in a small kitchen and not get along. Mm. And so, you know, I'm not sure how I had the strength, but I went to my partner and said, you know, you run this, I'll do something else. And in hindsight, that turned out to be a very good decision. But when I left, you know, my wife had just quit her job because we had two little kids at home. And so neither of us had a job. We had no bank balance. And it was tough. But I think each of those situations really broaden your comfort zone, you know, particularly for somebody like me who grew up in a very middle class, very safe kind of a environment. Anything slightly going wrong is not accepted. And when you go through these situations, it really sort of makes you, you know, realize that things really are not that risky. And you can be bold. You can just do things that you really want to do. Mm. And so I think most of the successes always have some failure behind them where people go through that and just get the courage to do things in a bigger and bolder way.
Mm. Well, that when you were at that point when, you know, things were difficult and you did have a family you had to take care of and you were, you know, didn't have an enormous amount of money in the bank and you were cutting your own grass, whatever that was, did you, at that time, did you feel that you were confident that you would be able to be success? Now, whether you sat there and you said to yourself, one day I'm going to be a billionaire, well, you know, I don't know if anybody ever really does that or if they do, whether they really believe it. But was it clear-cut in your mind, even at that point, you said, maybe it's going to be difficult and maybe it's going to take time and it's going to take hard work and maybe it's going to take some luck and all that kind of stuff, but that you felt really confident that sooner or later, one way or another, you were going to be successful.
Yeah. And also, you know, my wife was a tremendous support, you know, because if your partner doesn't support, then it just falls apart very quickly. Mm-hmm. But both of us, you know, felt like we had a great education. So making a living, you know, getting a simple living is never at risk. And so why worry about it, right? I mean, so we had a very simple lifestyle. So we didn't really have, you know, and that's a very useful lesson. You know, if you want to take risks in life, if you want to do things that you really want to do, you better have a very simple life so that you can actually afford to do things that you really want to do. And that really worked to our big advantage because we had such a simple life mm-hmm. that it looked risky, but we knew we could get through. And so focusing on things that we really wanted to do was still a lot of fun.
Hmm. Wait, how old are your kids now?
I have two boys, 21 and 23 years old.
And so, what do they do? What are they interested in?
Well, you know, they're both techies. They both went to MIT. They finished their master's. The younger guy is heading to Stanford to do a PhD, and the older guy has become an entrepreneur.
Hmm.
He started a company about 3 months ago, and it's been fun seeing him struggle through the thing. So.
Hmm. I just wonder, you know, when you have children that are fortunate enough to be born into a family with that level of success, how it is you instill in them the feeling that's not something to be taken for granted, and that what you're expecting them to do is you know, go and do their own thing and do their own work and make their own way, and that you're, you know, that you can help them to a certain extent, but that there's going to be a limit to what it is that you're going to be able to do for them.
Well, you know, I think a big factor in that is probably my wife. And she's always kept it down to earth and never drawn the identity of any one of us because of the car you drive or the wealth that you have. And in fact, sometimes maybe, you know, when things really go well, because I have a whole bunch of companies now that are doing really well, and sometimes you do feel cocky. But when I come home, she always points to the choral networks, you know, when you
because when you
start these companies as an entrepreneur, you always put a few hundred dollars into the company, mm-hmm. and that company, after 3-4 years of survival, it got sold, and I got a check for $26.95, which was a tax loss. So she has that check framed. So anytime I get cocky, she says, "Well, look at that."
Yeah, so, you got your cascades, and then you got your corals. Yeah, you know, you can it can be one or the other.
Yeah. So I think I think just the concept of, you know, doing things that are fun to do, I think is a, we're fortunate both the kids sort of, they made their own life and they do things that are fun for them. So,
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Gururaj Deshpande. He's co-founder and chairman of Sycamore Networks Incorporated, one of a couple of very successful IT firms that he started. The other one was Cascade Communications, something that started out as a one-person startup and grew to the point where it was sold for $3.7 billion. He's doing very well now, certainly with Sycamore. He's here visiting the campus to take part in a big conference on IT technology, people from all over the place here being involved. He was born and grew up in India, studied electrical engineering at the Indian Institute of Technology, and then went to Canada for his advanced degrees. He has a degree in electrical engineering from University of New Brunswick and PhD in data communications from Queen's University in Canada. And questions are certainly welcome. We have a couple people here who are standing by, and we'd like to get them in here, starting with someone in Champaign. Line number one. Hello.
Hello. Two quick questions on the philanthropic side of life. Are people like yourself who have great wealth, are you just bothered to death by people asking for some of it? Or do people kind of afraid to even bring up the subject? And the second question is, how then do you decide who to give money to?
That's a good question. You know, I think I find that people who have wealth, you know, the entrepreneurs, like what I like to do is to sort of get ahead of the curve. I want to come up with initiatives that I can think of. You know, just like you start a company and you build a large company, I like to come up with these philanthropic initiatives where I have an idea that I want to start, and then they can use an enormous amount of resource, a lot more than what I can contribute myself. So I already have things that I'm doing as opposed to being reactive. If you don't do that, then I think you can get caught. What happens is that then people just come and say, well, you know, once you give me 100,000 here, 200,000 here, a million here, 5,000 here, and so on. And then it's sort of, you know, I don't find that to be that satisfying. So I've been fortunate that we sort of stayed ahead of the curve. We built a staff. So we sort of work on strategies where we come up with a program that hopefully has a big impact and which can use the resources and the time that we can give to that effort.
Does that get at your question there, Colin?
Very informative. Thank you.
All right. Let's talk with someone here on a cell phone, someone from Milford, and it's our line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Fascinating program. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
A couple of quick points, and I'll ring off. Really take my hat off to your guest. I think the vast majority of people, and I put myself in that group, you know, you work at a job and you pay your mortgage and you watch your kids grow up, never really ever contemplating implementation of an idea or the kind of the money that you're talking about. So I really find that fascinating. My question is, I was wondering if your guests had any concerns, number one, about what I'm hearing is the vast, great importance of education. My concern is the state of education in this country where the gap between the haves and the have-nots are widening, and the kids going to school today, you know, what their future would be look like if they don't follow their education through. And then my other question, the other point, if he wants to comment, is the changing demographics in this country, the aging baby boomers, and if he thought that was going to have any impact, number one, on education, and number two, on philanthropy. And I'll go ahead and ring off and listen. Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
You know, that's a very good question. And in fact, the conference that we are having in University of Illinois today, the keynote speaker this morning, Anita Jones, talked a lot about, you know, the there's a report that's being put together called The Gathering Storm, where U.S. has always led the world in science and technology and innovation. And I think it's very important that U.S. continue to do that. And so I'm hoping that the government will approve the recommendation that they'll come together where, you know, they would inject thousands of teachers and millions of kids getting more interested in science and technology and so on. So I think I'm very, very, supportive and push every opportunity that I get with the people, with the Congress and senators to support those kinds of initiatives, because I think that's what will keep U.S. ahead of the game. Now, in terms of the aging population and the demographics and so on, I'm hoping that philanthropy will play a role. But even more than that, entrepreneurship. You know, I think entrepreneurship should not be viewed as something that only young people can do. I'm very impressed with some of the people who retire and then get into their 60s and 70s and certainly find a passion. They see something in the world, they want to see change, and they jump on it. And so I'm hoping that entrepreneurship will something that will keep people going in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s and not only make their life fulfilling, but also make them big contributors to the economy.
So what sort of philanthropic activities have you been involved with?
Well, the big one is the one in MIT, where we're really trying to bring innovation to relevance and so create the innovation, create a whole bunch of new companies, new jobs and impact and so on. But I think the innovation can be useful at all levels, whether it's improving education here or, for example, one of the initiatives that we're doing in India is bringing innovation to solve the real hard problems. Out of the billion people in India, there's about half of them who can't read and write and so on. And so a lot of the kids who go to school, they actually go hungry. And so talking about curriculum, all the sophisticated stuff doesn't make any sense. So a program that we funded a few years ago, it's called Akshay Patra, which means a vessel that gives forever. It's a nonprofit organization that started serving midday lunch program. And so for 10 cents, they actually serve a hot meal. And the way they do that is by building a kitchen, which costs a few million dollars. So it's a pretty sophisticated kitchen. And each kitchen can serve about 200,000 kids. And so in the last 4 years, they've scaled it up to 800,000 kids every day. And they're going to be up to a million kids in 18 months. And the reason they can do it is because, it's very interesting in India that you actually have people who understand global economy and serve in a lot of very, very broad perspective, but you also have these very basic problems. And so I see that a great opportunity to get the intersection going between people who can think of scale, people who can think of management, people who can think of technology, and then apply that talent to solve these problems that really need to get solved. Mm.
It's interesting that earlier in the week we were having a conversation here on the program about international development, and I had a couple of guests who are both professors at the university. And one of the things that we were talking about is the kind of debate, in a sense, between people who argue for very large-scale governmental kind of projects, things that, say, the government of the United States might do or that the United Nations might do, that are very large, very ambitious, have many parts, and are intended to do a lot of things. Comparing that with perhaps a smaller kind of a project that might be done by a private nonprofit foundation or a non-governmental organization, where the goal would be much more narrowly targeted, rather than saying we're going to work on 50 things, we're going to pick one, mm-hmm. just this one thing, narrowly target there. And work on that problem. And in that case, a lot of those efforts can be extremely successful, and you can get a lot of positive results from a relatively small amount of money. At least, per the amount of money you're spending per capita, per person, for what you get can be a lot. Do you think that there is greater potential in efforts like that than, and that perhaps we ought to be thinking more on that scale, and maybe not quite so much about enormous governmental programs essentially aimed at doing some of the same things?
Right. So, the way I like to approach these is I like being very entrepreneurial about something that works, but at the same time, scale it, right? So, for example, this midday lunch meal, which need to scale to 1 million, 10 million, and then 100 million to really have the impact, you need the government to be involved with it. But what you show is that you know, a lot of the governments, they put in a dollar and maybe 5 cents comes out of it, right? So if you can actually show a process and a mechanism where you can put a dollar and all the dollar comes out, then, you know, and that's what's happening with this program in India that we're doing right now. So the government is a full participant in this program at this point because they're seeing that, you know, in a democracy, they have to get the votes. And they, as long as the citizens are asking for it, you get a lot of government support. So using the philanthropic money and the entrepreneurial energy to prove the prototypes and to show that they work, and then using the partnership with government to scale those, is a good model. And that's the model that U.S. has used. I mean, in fact, the midday lunch program here was started by Ford Foundation after the Depression. And then it was so successful that the government took over and then ran the whole program. So, but I think starting without having the proven prototype, giving the government a lot of money to do something is probably a waste of time.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Gururaj Deshpande, and someone called in and said, "Will I please spell his last name?" So I will do that for you: Deshpande. And is his name. He's founder and chairman of Sycamore Networks Incorporated, has started up a number of very successful IT firms and has done quite well. And in financial terms, if no other, he's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to take place in a large conference, talking about some of these issues, about the directions that the IT field is going, about entrepreneurship, about partnerships involving universities and private business. Touching on all of those sorts of things. And questions here, again, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I certainly think that we're seeing more and more of these public-private partnerships in the sense of we have universities partnering with businesses and working together, particularly in this field, in high-tech IT field. And certainly it's been beneficial for universities because they've been facing increasing financial pressures as they receive less public money, less governmental money. So for this is a great infusion of cash. What does that do for – what do you think that does for both parties here to have that kind of partnership? What do you think that it does for the university and then on the business side? What does it do for them?
You know, I think there's been a fundamental shift where the researchers at universities were sort of more used, not more as an educational tool. But what's happened is that, and a lot of the research in U.S. Used to be done at places like Bell Labs and IBM and so on. Mm. And they could afford to fund that because they were monopolies. Not anymore, right? Because every company is now globally has to compete. So they have to justify every dollar that they put in. And therefore, they're all cutting the basic research dollars. And so the basic research responsibility has clearly moved to universities. So the universities have to step up to that responsibility to create the core knowledge. At the same time, I mean, the good thing about U.S. is that there's so many smart people who have so many smart ideas that you can't find enough dollars to fund all their ideas. So the project that we're working on at MIT is to see if there's a way you can connect innovation with relevance and have that innovation actually create value, economic value. Mm. And then you can bring a piece of that value back into the economy, into the cycle of innovation. So instead of having innovations that sort of sit on the shelf for 20 years or 50 years, if we can string those innovations in a way so that they create value, you get a bigger impact. You know, U.S. spends about $45 billion in university research. And so if there is a way you can have a bigger impact of that dollars that go into university research, then there's going to be a lot more money available for research at universities.
Mm-hmm. And is there, I suppose some people would ask the question, because private business, if they are going to be funding research, they're going to be expecting a return on the investment, obviously. So they're going to think very carefully about what they're going to get back. And particularly, I'm sure they're thinking about, well, are we going to get something that we're going to be able to patent and sell? And obviously, that's their motivation. Given that, does that at all restrict the kind of research that is done? And are we still doing enough research that is sort of pure and open-ended, and we're not really quite sure where it will lead? And sometimes that can lead to really interesting places. But are we really concentrating more on something that that a company would really feel, I think that there's a good chance we're going to be able to make money on this. So let's put it into there, and blue sky stuff, you know, somebody else can do that.
Well, you know, I think that's a good question. And so the model that we are working at MIT is not really to compromise your autonomy to do what you want to do. So it's not really tied to companies funding the research at MIT. It's more the philanthropic money, right? It's more you take the innovation, find the relevance, you create companies, you create wealth. And if you create a lot of wealth, somebody will give you the money back. And that money that comes back is more philanthropic money, which has no ties, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's a nonprofit. And so my hope is that the university research will create wealth, and a piece of that wealth will come back into the universities to fund that research, not with contracts, not research contracts, but more through philanthropy, which would give the full freedom to universities to do what they need to do.
We have several callers here. We'll try to get in all three if we can, starting with line one. They're all in Champaign, so starting with line one. Hello.
Yes, this is fascinating, and I'm glad you're maximizing wealth. I just read an article in the concerning the 10th anniversary of the death of Mother Teresa, and it was couched in terms of the abject poverty exists in your home country, India, and I think it mentioned one-third of Indians, which I guess would be one-third of a billion, live on $1 a day or less. My question to you, as an Indian who got at least your first degree from a well-regarded Indian university, is what of this wealth that you've accumulated do you give back to those Indians who are far less fortunate than you?
Yes, no, that's a good question. And I think, you know, there is 300 million people who don't have it. So if you had $300 million, you could give them a dollar apiece and probably wouldn't solve any problem. So the question is, when you have some resources and you want to put it to work, what's the most creative entrepreneurial way that you can actually come up with programs that can impact those masses? And that's the challenge, and that's the problem. And it's pretty exciting. And actually, what's exciting is that there's a lot of enlightened people, a lot of university professors, a lot of intellectuals thinking about that. You know, how do you actually alleviate poverty, and what's a good way to do it? And also do it in an efficient way.
Are you doing anything now that's, quote, creative to eliminate abject poverty for Indians who are very impoverished on a mass scale?
Yeah, so what we've done is we've created a Silicon Valley of social entrepreneurship in one part of India. So it's a region of about 8 million people. And what we're doing there is funding a whole bunch of nonprofit activity, about 50 of them, with the hope that you can actually bring in enough intellectual talent, enough resources, enough engineering talent to come up with programs that actually optimize these things. And one of the first programs that came out of that effort was this midday lunch program, where for $28 you can actually feed a kid for the whole year. And so if you feed, let's say, a few million kids for 10 years and get them through the high school education, it will hopefully change their life forever.
That's correct. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to line number two. This is also Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Earlier you alluded to your lifestyle before you had really begun taking risks as being simple. I'd like to know if you could elaborate on what you mean by having a simple lifestyle earlier in your career. And then the second question is a little bit unrelated, but in terms of the IT industry, do you think that those of us that are working in the non-programming, more of the networking and security aspects of the IT industry, whether there'll be job growth in that part of the IT industry? Thanks.
Okay.
Well, you know, in terms of the simple life that I was talking about is, you know, I think it's too bad that the savings rate in U.S. is so low now. And you know, it's good that it keeps the economy going because people are spending money. But I see too many situations where young people, you know, cannot even get through 2 weeks without a paycheck. And when you get into situations like that, you lose a lot of your freedom. You know, would be nice if, you know, a kid who just comes out of college who's used to living like a student, if he continues to live like a student, he can put a lot of money away in a bank. And then if he wants to take a year off to do an entrepreneurial activity or start something new, he would have that freedom. And so having a lifestyle that's simple, which is not financially demanding, is a huge advantage. So I think that's an advantage that a lot of the people don't leverage. They get too lost in a lot of the, you know, catching up with the Joneses, I think. In terms of the job opportunities, you know, I think IT has a long way to go because IT is going to continue to penetrate a lot of the sectors of the economy, whether it's energy or transportation, because what needs to do next happen is that the information exchange needs to make each one of these systems a lot more efficient. And that's just going to require IT penetrating every segment of the industry. So I wouldn't be worried about having opportunities to work in those things. I think it's something that's good for another 25 years.
All right. One more caller here. This is Champagne also, line 3. Hello.
My interest is in immigration policy. It seems the U.S. is working hard to try to keep people out and thinking of illegal immigrants coming across the border. But the other part of that is how to effectively allow very competent, well-trained people who want to come to this country to come to this country. And my impression is that we put a lot of barriers up. What changes do you see that we need in the immigration area for intelligent, well-trained, et cetera, people who are attempting to enter the country legally?
You know, the Kauffman Foundation and Duke University just put out a study that showed that 50% of the companies have been started with people who came from outside. You know, somehow that's been the culture in the United States where immigrants come in, and as an outsider, you see opportunities a lot more than people who are here, right? And so the job creation and demand creation for talent and opportunities is a big part of the U.S. economy. And there's, you know, and what used to happen is that a lot of us, when we came 30 years ago, let's say from India, after we got educated, we, you know, there was sort of a very good reason to stay back here. And even if things were a little hard, you would cope up with it and somehow find opportunities within U.S. But not anymore, because opportunities are opening up in India, in China, in other parts of the world. So unless U.S. somehow rolls out a red carpet to smart people that come here to study and engage them into the economy, I think we're going to be the losers. And U.S. needs to make sure that they act on that.
We're down here to the point where we have maybe about a minute or so left. Is there any, in terms of what is on the horizon technologically, is there anything that you think is particularly exciting, something that perhaps we're not that most people are not thinking about right now? I'm sure there are people who are thinking about it. Most people are thinking about now that is another thing that's going to come along and, in a sense, change everything. It's going to be revolutionary and change our lives and the way that we do things in ways now that we wouldn't be thinking about?
Oh, it's just dramatic. You know, mm-hmm. I think the kind of research that's going on in whether it's University of Illinois or MIT or Stanford, it's just mind-boggling. You know, whether it's a field of energy. In fact, I have a company, I'm a chairman of a company called A123 Systems, which makes these rechargeable batteries for cars, which probably will revolutionize the way people use autos, healthcare, you know, and all the nanotechnology, the drug delivery systems, the tissue engineering. It's just amazing the rate at which, the pace at which things get developed now because, and that's the beauty of the connected world. You know, the ideas move so fast that we're going to be in an era of exponential innovation, which means in the next 10 years, our lives will change as much as it has changed the last 100 years. So I think we're all in for a very exciting future, and every change is led by an entrepreneur. So for those of you who want to be entrepreneurs, I think there'll be a tremendous number of opportunities.
Well, I guess that we're going to have to finish up with our thanks to our guest, Gururaj Deshpande. He's the founder and chairman of Sycamore Networks, Incorporated. Here's him visiting the campus for a big conference, talking about these kinds of issues here, right, going on right now. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David.